American schools have struggled to close what's called the minority achievement gap, lower average test scores, grades, and college attendance rates among Black and Latino students. Typically, children who are falling behind are placed in remedial classes intended to help them catch up. But some schools are starting to say that the way they group students by ability, often called tracking or leveling, can cause more problems than they solve. Nancy Solomon spent last year as a Spencer Fellow in Education reporting to examine why good suburban schools are failing Black students.
The hallways at Columbia High School in Maplewood, New Jersey, are a picture postcard of integration. Columbia is a well-funded school that's roughly 60% Black and 40% white. The kids mix easily with a super friendly vibe. But when the bell rings, students go their separate ways. This is Noel Cooperberg's repeat algebra class, a class of all minority kids who flunked last year. There are only about a dozen students. The school keeps lower-level classes small to try to boost success. But a group of girls sitting in the middle never so much as pick up a pencil and disrupt the class throughout. It's an entirely different scene in Cooperberg's honors-level pre-calculus class, which has three times as many students, and most of them are white.
Take a couple of minutes and try to solve this.
These two classes are pretty typical. Lower-level classes, called levels 2 and 3, are overwhelmingly Black, while 4 and 5 are mostly white. Students are assigned to these levels by a combination of grades, test scores, and teacher recommendations.
You could look at the highest achieving kid and the lowest achieving kid and say, oh my God, they're worlds apart, right?
The problem, says Amy Stuart Wells of Columbia University's Teachers College, is how kids in the vast middle are sorted. The racial segregation corresponds to the difference in average test scores between Black and white students at the school and nationally. But Stuart Wells says racial stereotypes still play a role.
And what you're seeing in suburbia and how it's playing out along racial lines is testimony to the fact that race still matters quite a bit in the society and very much so in education.
The two towns served by the school are diverse, middle-class suburbs, although a third of the students are low-income, and almost all of those kids are Black. But a considerable number of the African-American students are middle and upper-middle class.
My name's Hanif Quinn. I was born and raised here. I'm 16 years old. I'm a very intellectual student. I think I'm really actually the smartest underachiever in Columbia High School.
Hanif lives in a large house in a solidly middle-class neighborhood. He has two older siblings who've gone on to college, and he says his parents pushed him to do well. His freshman year, Hanif was placed in level 4 classes, one of a small group of African-American students.
We kind of sat together, the Black kids over here and the white kids over here. It seemed like the teacher, she just stayed on the other side of the room away from us. The teacher focused on the larger group of whites and left us in the dust.
I've heard that so many times.
Columbia principal Lovie Lilly, who is African-American, is troubled by the racial segregation in leveled classes. She says the levels do reflect differences in skill and work habits, but she believes race plays a part. Lilly conducted research on the experience of Black students at her school while studying for her Ph.D.
Black children in higher-level classes were ignored or perceived that they were being ignored, or they did not feel comfortable going to the teacher after school to get help. They gave up and decided to go to level 3 classes, where at least there were other Black children.
But this comfort comes with a penalty. Lower-level classes ask less of students, so they do less. The school district's new superintendent, Brian Osborne, who is white, says the lack of rigor in lower levels is his top priority for change.
The second day that I was here as superintendent, I met with a group of middle school students for lunch. And I asked the students, what are your teachers' expectations of you? And the very first thing that one of the students told me was, it depends what level you're in.
The question Osborne has yet to answer is whether lower-level classes can hold students to higher standards, or whether any sorting system sends the wrong message.
Our first day, you know, going to that class, we made a nickname for the class. We called it the retarded class.
Jerry Mournville, a recent graduate, remembers his level 2 class and how the low expectations affected the way students felt about themselves and about school.
We were mad. A lot of kids, you know, were being rude to the teachers and stuff like that. That class was crazy. It was like every African American or black ethnic friend I knew in my grade, they were all in that class.
For the past 20 years, proposals to get rid of levels at the school have been defeated by the well-organized parents of highest-performing students, who tend to be affluent and white, and who fear their kids will be slowed down by mixed-ability classes. Teachers are also divided. Richard Moss is an African-American math teacher with 37 years' experience.
I've done both. When you have kids mixed together, then you're going to find that this group of kids at this level cannot work at the same level as someone else, okay? So that it makes it difficult to organize, and then the frustration level increases at both ends.
So we're ready for the squire now. So
on the other side of this issue is Lean Marshall, who teaches a demanding medieval literature class to a mixed group of kids from levels 2, 3, and 4. The class began as a scheduling mistake, but it turned out to work.
Which of you is going to present the squire? Chanel?
Lean Marshall is calling on Chanel Saint, who's been in level 2 classes since middle school. Yet here he is in Marshall's class, explaining the character of the squire in the Canterbury Tales, and doing it well.
Great, Chanel. A lot of fire.
I saw in the kids who wanted the opportunity a light open up. The kids who had been used to, I guess, doing very basic work, whose English classes, for whatever reason, hadn't been challenging, would come up to me and say, we've just never thought this way before. No one's ever asked us these questions before.
Superintendent Brian Osborne is moving gingerly toward change. He's created a task force to study leveling in Maplewood, and he's hoping to convince parents that education is not a zero-sum game, that the schools can boost the lowest performers while improving achievement for all. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Solomon.
And tomorrow in the second part of our series, we'll explore how race matters in the education of teenagers. Visit npr.org to see audio slideshows about Columbia High School.
Researchers and educators have long puzzled over the so-called minority achievement gap. The term is often used to characterize the lower average test scores, grades, and college attendance rates by black and Latino students compared to their white counterparts. Reporter Nancy Solomon spent time at a suburban New Jersey high school where she examined what some consider to be the causes of the disparities. She has this report.
All right, so you ready to start sociology?
Okay. Columbia High School teacher Melissa Cooper begins class by projecting a collage of face shots onto a screen and asking students what they would think if they saw these people walking down the street. The students say the Latino-looking guy is a drug lord. The white guy in a tweed suit is smart.
How does he look like he's smart?
He got glasses.
Cooper is African-American, 32, and she's been teaching for 10 years at this Maplewood, New Jersey school, which is roughly 60% black and 40% white. She pushes her students to challenge stereotypes, even the ones they have about themselves.
Class, do I look like a sociology teacher?
No. If I see you walking down the street, I would, like, ask you how much you do, like, perms and touch-ups and stuff. Oh. I'd be like, you probably work at the beauty salon and then...
Yeah, beauty salon, it's very interesting because it speaks to how they imagine themselves, you know. Sometimes people who are like us are just our mirror, what we're capable of.
Cooper says racial stereotypes are so powerful that black kids are much more limited in how they see themselves, even in a place like Maplewood, which is largely middle class.
You know, it's a freedom that white children have that black children don't have. They get to pick from this huge array of personality types, behaviors, authentic selves that they can put on and take off. There's a challenge for black children. When they go to the identity closet, what guise they can put on and take off and still be considered authentically black.
This question of black teenagers and their identity is a clue to the mystery of why middle-class black kids aren't keeping pace with white and Asian students. Middle-class black students do just as well in elementary school, but as they become teenagers, they begin to fall behind. Pedro Nogueira, sociology of education professor at New York University, says middle-class black kids have the same benefits as middle-class white kids, two parents at home, lots of support, and extracurricular activities. but many of them want to be more like poor kids.
Because in many black communities, it is the kind of the ethos, the style, the orientation of poor black kids that influences middle-class black kids in ways that's not true for middle-class white kids. Most middle-class white kids don't know poor white kids.
But middle-class black kids know and are often related to poor black kids. And of course, they're influenced by media images that glorify the rough-and-tumble street. This can cause a lot of confusion for kids, especially as they become teenagers.
I used to be the geek. I used to be the geek in the class, always raising my hand, like the teacher's pet.
Keith Cordy was 14 and flunking ninth grade when I met him, but he had skipped first grade at the recommendation of his teacher.
During fifth grade, I just like felt like I didn't have any friends, so I tried to fit in. I started doing less work, always with my friends, always in the back playing around and stuff like that.
Keith's mom, Angela Gunnings, and his stepdad, Michael Elder, moved from Brooklyn to New Jersey partly because they wanted Keith in a suburban school, but his grades continued to plummet.
And I noticed a change from him being this young, sweet, listen to mommy boy, you know, to all of a sudden, you know, developing a swagger, if you will, that's not always the right swagger to develop. And I tell him all the time, we're trying to save your life, essentially.
What have you tried to do to help him?
What haven't we tried to do?
They've met with his teachers, bought him study guides, punished him, and sent him to summer school. But they're up against larger forces, especially since they live at the intersection of two worlds. Walk out their door and to the left is an affluent suburb. To the right is Newark, poor, urban, and black.
And a lot of the kids, from what I could see, want to identify and want to be down and want that, you know, that street credibility, you know, so they know they can get it by crossing the imaginary border or the border as it is, you know.
So when a youngster like Keith walks into class late with his pants sagging, sits in the back and doesn't participate, he's basically striking a pose.
I think that's the trap that many minority kids have fallen into.
Prudence Carter of Stanford University studied 70 low-income black and Latino kids at a New York school and disagrees with the idea that black kids think doing well in school is acting white. Instead, she says minority kids are conforming to a peer culture that gets in the way of forming good relationships with teachers or feeling part of a school community.
Those baggy pants, I may not like them necessarily. I might think you shouldn't show your underwear, but it doesn't have anything to do with what's going on in that kid's head. And unfortunately, we have policed and outlawed and denigrated these kids' styles to the point that they become disillusioned or become defiant. They're like, how dare you?
Some kids, Carter says, negotiate these two worlds. They're popular with the poor black kids, and they do well in school. She says those kids should become the model, and schools should train adults to help kids straddle the conflicting worlds of peer culture and the classroom, even about how kids dress, speak, or act in class.
And how you adapt in that situation so that you don't feel so completely overwhelmed or insecure. Because I think that's what happens oftentimes with kids, particularly the ones who are trying to figure out, how do I say to a teacher, I want to be here, or thinking, I know I'm supposed to be here, but the way you're handling this is making me ashamed.
If schools helped minority students with these sorts of relationships, Carter says, then they could become active, engaged participants without having to give up their cultural identity, or what some students call acting white. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Solomon.
Visit NPR.org for audio slideshows and more reporting on the Achievement Gap. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. The University of Akron is no football powerhouse, though it has sent a few players to the NFL. This year, a new $61 million stadium replaced the Depression-era Rubber Bowl, but the season may turn on a $100 help wanted ad in the student newspaper. From member station WKSU, ML Schulze explains.
The University of Akron football season was supposed to sound like this. And it did during the opening game on September 12th. But ever since, it sounds like this.
A very difficult game. You know, I thought the kids, our kids are playing hard. They're fighting.
Coach J.D. Brookhart's team is fighting a 1-6 record and the loss of 14 starters for the season. Akron Beacon Journal sports writer Tom Gaffney says no one could have seen that coming at the home opener of Akron's gleaming new stadium.
That day in September 12th, when they opened the stadium with Morgan State, and the dignitaries were there, and the skydivers were coming in there, and everything was festive and exciting. You had your first string quarterback who was in his third year, and then to see this.
This includes the help wanted ad. The last resort in a chain of events that started when the team dismissed that starting quarterback for still undisclosed violations. 2 weeks later, his backup tore a ligament. Quarterback number 3 had transferred out even before the season, convinced he'd never play. And that left a fourth-string freshman. And backing him up, a redshirted freshman, a student coaching assistant, and no one to run the scout squad in practices. So Coach Brookhart put a help-wanted ad in the student paper. And accounting major and former backup high school quarterback Mark Malachin answered it.
I looked at it and I said, this is an opportunity that can't be passed up. So I just emailed the coach and he told me to come in for an interview, and then he scheduled a time to try out, and I did. Football is my first sport. It's the one I love the most, and this was an opportunity that couldn't be passed up.
So Malachin celebrated his 19th birthday this week, calling plays in a stadium that's a smaller version of some of the best in the country. He's playing the role of this week's opponent, Northern Illinois, for an Akron team so bruised it's practicing in shorts instead of pads. The classified ad may have been a desperate act, but Coach Brookhart says it was his last option.
We don't even have a travel squad of scholarship players right now, so we need bodies to practice.
Akron needs more than quarterback bodies. A linebacker with severe flu played the entire game against Syracuse last week. Another finished the game the week before with a broken arm. And one star has been stretched so far that he's only the second player in the nation to start at 3 different positions. Brookhart says that's the measure of his team.
A bunch of guys played special teams positions they've never practiced. So the heart of this team I'm very proud of.
Running back Gary Pride says Akron can't be defined only by its record.
No team in the nation just wants to go out there and just lose games and lose starting quarterbacks and, you know, other teammates, but we just want to win.
For those who worry about such things as wins and losses, they can look to the University of Akron's Division I soccer team. It's undefeated and ranked number 1 in the country. For NPR News, I'm M.L. Schulze in Akron, Ohio.
School's out today for many kids in Hawaii. It's the second of 17 furlough Fridays the state has imposed to close a big gap in its education budget. Hawaii has instituted one of the most drastic public school teacher furloughs in the country. Parents are up in arms. State officials are scrambling. From Hawaii Public Radio, Ben Marcus reports.
At Kahala Elementary in Honolulu, kids are herded along a shaded walkway into a school's cafeteria. It was in this cafeteria several weeks ago that Joe Curran, mother to a first grader, banded together with other moms worried about looming furlough Fridays.
And from that meeting, a little voice, someone sitting next to me, said we should really march on the Capitol.
They formed Hawaii Education Matters, and last Friday they indeed marched on the Capitol.
Some 700 parents and children rallied at the state capitol today to protest cuts to education on furlough.
State capitol turned into an outdoor classroom on this first furlough Friday.
Protests were also taken to court. 2 class action lawsuits were filed against the state. Eric Seitz is one of the lead attorneys. He's encouraged by the protests because he says it will take public outrage to move state government.
The outcome of this whole issue is going to be a defining moment in the political life of this community and for a long time to come. And it's very critical, I think, that we resolve this problem sooner than later, because the long-term effects are going to be horrible.
Hawaii students already test well below the national average. More than 60% of island schools haven't met adequate yearly progress under the federal education program known as No Child Left Behind. Garrett Taguchi is chair of the Hawaii Board of Education. He says there just weren't many other options after a 14% cut to education funding this year. He says officials warned the public months ago this was coming.
And the public didn't pay attention. And, you know, understandably, because it probably wasn't happening, maybe people thought it wasn't going to happen. But we knew it was going to happen. And so when it finally did happen, the public's reaction is not surprising, but it is sadly maybe a bit too late.
After the protests last Friday, Governor Linda Lingle, who signed off on the furloughs, backpedaled and said she now thinks they were a mistake, and the state Senate has formed a special committee to look into options to restore the lost instructional time. Again, Chair Taguchi.
I'm very pessimistic that anything will be done, but on the other hand, I'm optimistic that I'll be proven wrong.
Until lawsuits are settled or state government can work out a compromise, parents of the more than 170,000 public school kids across the state are stuck, wondering what to do with their kids on furlough Fridays. Back at Kahala Elementary, Jo Curran has decided to put her son Max in a learning enrichment program.
You know, classroom time is just not something that can be compromised. It's just as simple as that. It's not a debating tool.
But at $30 a day, it's not something everyone here can afford. For NPR News, I'm Ben Marcus in Honolulu.